We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hey, this is Ryan Barney. You're watching Shout Out Loud Cast, and we're playing lots of good music. I know these guys are great fans of rock and roll, and that's what we deliver. See you all soon. Please come and see us when we play in America. I want to!
That's right. We're back with another episode of Dorm Damage, the show where anything and everything is on the table and the table gets smashed. Episode 58. And this week, this is one of our personal favorites. A thrill for us to have this guy on this week, Zeus. Who joins us this time?
This time we have Joe Lynn Turner, JLT, joins us. From Eastern Europe. He worked with us to get this scheduled. We really appreciated it because he's like 8 or 9 hours ahead, and we managed to do it on a weekend, and boy, was this worth it.
We've been lucky enough to have a ton of great guests lately, but this one is really, really special to Zeus and I. We've been a huge fan of him for ages, whether it's Rainbow, Yngwie, solo material, whatever, and we just had a blast, and we can't wait for you guys to hear it.
Without further ado, Joe Lynn Turner.
All right, this week we are thrilled to have a legend in the house. One of the great vocalists in rock, a huge one that we love here. You know him from his music with Rainbow, with Yngwie Malmsteen, his solo career, and so much more. It's an honor to welcome the great Joe Lynn Turner to the show this week. Joe, welcome. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, guys. Much appreciated.
Really. Excellent.
So, Joe, most of our listeners and myself, we got introduced to you from Rainbow. Right. I can remember some of the earliest videos, and I'm like 10 years old or something, and catching you on Stone Cold and Street of Dreams and things like that. Now, I know that at some point you came into Rainbow right as Difficult to Cure was a kind of getting started already, and Graham, who's a friend of the show, we love Graham, was leaving at that point. And I think they had already done maybe one song, I Surrender, at least, or something. And then you came in and did all the tracks. Is that right?
Yeah. Hey, Graham's a good friend of mine, by the way.
We love him. Him and his wife are fantastic.
They're great.
People.
They're great. Yep.
Wonderful people, really. Yep. He's one of the sweethearts in his business.
That's
yeah,
awesome.
What happened was you're almost right there, because they didn't have, as far as I knew, a lead vocal, but they had Graham doing all the I Surrender harmonies backgrounds.
Yep. Okay.
So that's what I had heard. You know, I heard his backgrounds.
Gotcha.
And so I never heard, you know, well, what I heard was the Russ Ballard's demo.
Yeah.
And I just said, well, look, is it okay if I kind of move it around and change some things, you know? And they said, do what you want to do, style it yourself. And the upshot of that is Glenn wrote a really nice section on me saying that he never thought that song was a hit song, and that my phrasing and emotion and stylings really brought that thing together. So I was just like blown away by that statement, you know, because the one thing I do have, if anything, is a gift of melody and timing. So
for sure.
Yeah. And that's the thing that always stood out to me. So Rainbow, your solo stuff, your Yngwie, you know, you always to us, people of rock, that like hard rock, always have one of our favorite voices. And I think it's because it's that melodic voice that you have. I Surrender is almost like a perfect example of it. I absolutely love it. And your vocals, like when you're driving in the car and you're singing along to you, like I lose my voice halfway trying to do the I Surrender. It just doesn't work, but you make it seem effortless and it's a beautiful song. And I heard the other version of it. Yeah, you kind of made that one your own.
Yeah. I tried to do that with most things. You know, when you do a replacement singer syndrome, you know, the thing I try to do is give respect to the original singer. But at the same time, there's no way you're not them. So you have to make it your own.
Yeah.
You know, you just do. You really do.
Yeah. So, Joe, it's funny. If I'm sitting here thinking, if the 8-year-old version of me knew that I was talking to you right now. So I grew up, I found you on MTV. 8 years old, the Stone Cold video. And I always talk about how I had an older sister and we were obsessed with MTV and record stores and rock and music and pop and everything. And I remember hearing that song and being like, this is incredible. It brings together hard rock, melody, harmony, incredible stuff. And I was obsessed with Straight Between the Eyes and Difficult to Cure in that era of Rainbow. And when I got older and went back and discovered like the Dio years, like metal Rainbow, it was kind of the same thing with Yngwie when I discovered, you know, Rising Force, which is still to this day one of my favorite albums ever. And then discovered. So it's a long way of saying what you bring to these bands, I think, is such a tribute to your vocal styling and nothing against what Dio brought to Rainbow and what those guys brought to Yngwie. But you bring such a melodic pop sensibility to bands that may not otherwise have reached that type of people.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those kudos. What I was hired for, and I mean hired for, literally, I mean, it was articulated to me that Richie wanted to go more commercial.
Yep.
He wanted, look, everybody was coming out, Def Leppard and Foreigner and, you know, Aerosmith, and they were all had radio hits, you know, and Richie wasn't enjoying that at the time. Now, Richie is a big ABBA fan. He's a big Melody fan.
Yeah,
he really is. And he just said, look, we want to go more commercial, but we want to keep the edge. So there's a fine line between the integrity of keeping that hard rock edge and being commercial.
Yeah.
You know, and I think my version of Rainbow, but our version of Rainbow, we really accomplished that.
Totally.
We wrote for that. We recorded for that, you know, and we achieved that. We actually charted very well, you know, considering, and we sold more tickets and sold more albums than all the previous incarnations. So we did pretty good. But that was the point. Yngwie too. Yngwie was commercial.
I mean, I look at a song like Street of Dreams. I'm like, that is like one of the greatest songs of the 80s that like Journey wishes they had or Foreigner wishes they had. But you made that happen with Rainbow. And I find that amazing. And if we kind of fast forward a little bit to Rising Force, I mean, or Odyssey, you know, with Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force and Odyssey.
Right.
I mean, to this day, I still say that Heaven Tonight, and especially for me personally, I think Crystal Ball are two of the great songs of 80s hard rock. And I remember when I was younger, people being like, you got to listen to Yngwie, and they're playing, you know, like Trilogy and all like the real, like, you know, and I was like, oh, this is good. I'm like, I'm a vocal guy. I'm a singer guy. And I'm like, I like the music, but I there's something missing. And then Odyssey comes out, and I'm like, we hit the bullseye with Joe Lynn Turner again.
There you are. That, again, you know, Jim Lewis from PolyGram, was living in New York City, and I was a good friend of Jim because we go to the same clubs like the China Club and you know how it is in Boston when you pal out with everybody.
Yep.
And he just said, look, I need to have dinner with you next week and this, that, the other thing. We sat down, had a few cognacs after dinner, and he said, I want you to go with this guitar player He says he's a fabulous guitar player, but he just doesn't, you know, he doesn't write the hits. Mm. And I said, well, who is it? So he said, Yngwie Malmsteen. And I said, oh, I heard of this guy. Richie once pointed him out to me in a magazine. And said, this guy's trying to be me.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
So I just, you know, I never really got into his music. You know, I heard it. I heard some of the things he was doing with Jeff Scott Soto and so on and Mark Bowles. Yep. You know, I heard it, but it wasn't my cup of tea either, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said, gee, I don't know, Jim, this is going to work out. So he says, just trust me, trust me. He says, I've got this idea, you know, and I want you to do it. So the story is, real quickly, we flew out to L.A. and partied, and Yngwie blessed it because he was a big partier back in those days. And the rest is history, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hell of a story. But again, I was supposed to make it commercial. Now, on that album, as you just pointed out, we had that fine line of commercial, but yet it was pretty hard rocking some hard metal stuff on there.
Oh, you look at a song, Riot in the Dungeons or the Rising Force, that incredible stuff. But you're right, it still had the melody to it, but it was heavy.
Right. It had the edge and it had melody.
Yep.
And it really reached a lot of people, you know, and that's exactly what you want to do. There's no dirty word when you say you're accessible or you're commercial. It's not a dirty word, you know. That just means you're reaching more people and your message is, and your music is getting out there. There's no sin about that.
It's funny you say that, because your other Stephen client, Steve Vai, said the same thing, very similar to you. He's like, I got my commercial stuff. That's more, and he used the same word, accessible. And then he's like, I got my other stuff. I know my stuff that I do on my solo albums. That's not going top 40, but he's like, there's stuff that I have there that I wouldn't touch over the more commercial stuff they've done. And I get that, right?
Yep.
That's right. And what gets me is that people sort of crucify you over that. For what? What's the point?
Oh, no, that's the part of Rainbow that's very Kiss-like. You have like haters within the fan base, like, oh, you know, the commercial stuff, as soon as Graham and JLT came in, oh, no, that's not it. You just got to listen to the first three albums. Come on. Now, I will admit that this seems like it's almost like three different bands. It's the Dio band, and then there's the Graham, who's right in the middle between you guys. Right. The lyrics were still, other than the two hits, they were still kind of Dio-ish. And then you come in and make it a lot more accessible, but it's still good music, because it's obviously Richie is the common denominator there, but he's got great singers doing great things, and it's okay to like all three. You don't have to pick a side.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Exactly. It's not a team sport, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and even that's crazy, because you could be from Boston and you might like the Yankees. Oh my God.
No, you can't have that.
No, actually you can't.
I did that purposely.
I know.
but seriously, I used to love the Red Sox, by the way. Honest to God. I was a Red Sox. I was a Yankee fan. My blood is blue, but I like the Red Sox.
It's funny, and just kind of piggybacking what Zeus said about, you know, Rainbow. It's like me, I deal with that being a Metallica fan. So I love every era of Metallica. I think their latest album they released is spectacular. But people are like, anything after Injustice for All, they still the Black album, that's a sellout. Load, that's a sellout. I'm like,
what are you talking?
I'm like, why is it so? It's a, because it's you like accessible and melodic, and it has, you know, verse, chorus, verse. Like, I love Injustice for All, but not everybody wants to hear a 9-minute song by Metallica. And it's not a crime. It's not a crime to make melodic short songs that are great.
I remember Master of Puppets came out, and I was rocking to that. You know, we were on tour with Metallica. Metallica back then was opening for us.
Imagine
if you can believe it.
That's awesome.
Def Leppard opened for us.
Yep.
Yeah. opened for us, you know, and all these bands just took off. Why? Because they got radio play. We used to have radio in those days. No,
that's
more.
Right. That's right.
But anyway, the story is you take Master Puppet, you go all the way to Sandman. It's a different band.
Totally.
It's really a different sound, a different producer, a different vision, yep. Writing, a member change here and there, so on and so forth. And I don't know why fans hate change. For example, Deep Purple. How many Mach 4 or 5? Right.
Yeah, I never got the Mach part.
I love that. Yeah. You're right.
Man, but you got your version of it too. So I know. Oh. Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. You know, all of a sudden it's like, we hate this version, but we like that version. And essentially Deep Purple has been nothing but a revolving door.
Totally.
But between Rainbow, Deep Purple, Whitesnake, and Black Sabbath, I don't know what kind of incestual relationship all those bands have, but how many members have touched another member in that group of people, whether it's Coverdale, whether it's Tony Iommi, yourself, or Deep Purple, Roger Glover. It's all over the place. You guys have a bunch of different, but you're great musicians, so why do I care?
You know, right? Don Airey had
oh, there you go. Don Airey. Yeah.
Don Airey, that's right. Yep.
There we go. He had a great joke about that. You know, one day I think it was in the bus, and he just turned around and said, and he was looking at the family tree. I think it was like three center foldouts, you know,
exactly.
And he said, you know, someday we should get like an old folks home for all the members.
Yeah, exactly.
He says a small intimate place at about 300 rooms.
It's true.
Exactly. The personalities. Now, speaking of personalities, and I'm sure you've gotten this question lots of times, so I'm going to try to change it up a little bit. You've dealt with, let's call them large personalities. Richie Blackmore.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. Richie, Yngwie, and other members. And if you just look at the people that you've worked with, if you just go through like, stuff where you're like this session backing vocals that you've added to some of these great albums. For instance, you're on that Sheer album in 87 that I absolutely love. And I was taught, we had a favorite of ours, a guest, Desmond Child on. And I would say to him, what the hell was I doing in the middle of this like hard rock hair metal phase buying a Sheer album? I'm like, it was you. You're like the common denominator. You had something to do with it. And you're on too. And it's just, it seems like you've been around a ton of people. Anyone sticks out as being, let's say, wrongly maligned for being difficult versus that's dead on. This guy's a pain in the ass.
Look, you know, I tell the truth. I don't try to slag people off. I just tell the truth about people, you know, and looking back, I mean, I just came out with an interview and I was talking about Yngwie saying, I just don't agree with his production now and what he's doing, you know, and he thinks he can do it all. And I think that's a mistake, but that's just the truth, you know? And when I look back at say Yngwie, who was a difficult, large personality, you know, I understand he wants to keep his vision. I understand how he, you know, how he wanted to not sort of pollute his sound or something like this. But he doesn't understand that he doesn't have to lie that I wrote the lyrics. I wrote the melodies. He doesn't have to lie about that stuff. He doesn't have to say he hates all his singers, you know, from Mike Viscera to Chip.
And they're all great singers.
Right. You don't have to do that to prove anything.
Right.
So all I would say is, you know, that part of it is true. You know, I have no problems with Richie either, because Richie is a perfectionist, and I want things to be quote unquote perfectly imperfect too, as best as you can be. So I never faulted Richie for saying that's not good enough. If he were to tell me, you know, when he told me, for example, Street of Dreams.
Yep.
He went, you hit that spot on, man. The writing of it, the melodies, the subject matter. He goes, this is brilliant. It's one of his favorite songs to this day. But he would also turn around and say, oh, you missed the point on that one. You know, you go back and rewrite it. So, I mean, I never took offense to that or thought it was difficult. I just said he hears something that I can do better. And 90% of the time, I think I did.
Yeah. So totally. Totally.
How difficult is that? How difficult is that?
With Ricky, really, you just hear different stories of like being a curmudgeon or being difficult or being too much of a prankster and making life difficult for people if he doesn't like you. Interviews. And that's the other
interview thing. Yes.
Where he just fucks with people for a while. It just, God.
Well, look, he fucks with everybody. I mean, my initiation to the band, the new members when Dave Rosenthal came in, he goes out of his way to fuck people, their heads. I mean, I can tell you stories. Wait till a movie comes out. The stories are hysterical, what he's done. I mean, and you gotta love him because it's ingenious stuff.
Right,
prank stuff.
And I think it's because of that, unfortunately, as great as a guitarist he is and as his reputation, he should be even higher, in my opinion.
Oh, I agree.
He seems like he's right outside the door of the Clapton, Page, Beck, and then he's underneath that, where I think he should be right there.
Well, the funny thing about that is that when you talk about influential guitar, everybody brings up Blackmore. Everybody brings up Blackmore. But people are like predisposed to be like, oh, Richie Blackmore, he's great, but he's this, he's that. But you're right. I think you're right. You're right, Zeus. I think he's unfairly knocked down a few pegs because of what people think he is as a person.
Yeah.
You know, I the first thing that comes to my mind when you bring that up is, as far as all the other bands that just shot right past the projects that we were doing because he didn't continue another album with Rainbow in our style, I think we would have really cracked it but he don't give a shit. He gets to a point where he just is very content where he is.
Yep.
You know, he doesn't have to, you know, this whole Jimmy Page, Led Zepp thing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he just says, look, he doesn't give a shit about Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He doesn't get none of that.
Yeah.
He loves his music, what he plays. He's made his living. He's lived his dream or whatever. And everybody cites him as the master that they learned from.
Totally. Yeah, I agree.
So why didn't he surpass all of that? Because he really didn't want to. He didn't have to.
Yeah, he doesn't play the game. And I get that. I mean, look what he's doing now. God bless him. He enjoys it. But I don't want to hear Richie Blackmore do woodland music with his like elf like band. I want him to rock out and do like the shit he was doing with you guys. But
yeah,
he enjoys it. And you know he doesn't need the money. He doesn't give a fuck. This is what he wants to do. This is what he does.
But that's what he loves. Honest to God.
Yeah.
I think I had a hand in that because when I first met Candace, her name was Candy.
Okay.
And in Florida, and we were doing a football game, a soccer game, and for WDIZ, a charity. And we were taking off our gear and whatnot, our suit, our cleats and all that stuff. And she came up to me. She thought I was Richie at first. And she said, so anyway, we were talking and I explained Richie's over there doing an interview. She said, well, what kind of music does he really like? And I said, truly, he likes Renaissance music.
Ah.
And she said, so wait. So she says, like, you mean Annie Hanselman? And I said, no. We're talking 16th century type stuff. I said, there's a quartet in Germany. He follows around to all the castles. These guys just play quartet, you know, with lutes and old instruments. This is what he loves. And she nailed him, man. She came in and she told him, I guess, that she loved the same thing. And
the rest is history.
That's it.
Oh, man.
Joe, I have to.
So I'm blaming you then.
Okay. Yeah, it's your fault.
Isn't everything? Ask my wife. It's the same with her. Yeah.
I want to go back to Odyssey just because to this day, that's such an album I hold so close to me, probably because it didn't blow up and get overplayed.
What we did with it too.
Yeah. So we have a couple different side podcasts, and one of them is called the Album Review Crew, where we pick one album a month and we spend like 3 hours picking it apart.
Yeah. Non-Kiss album.
And when it came time for me a couple of years ago, I picked Odyssey, and I just gushed over the album. I had the cassette. I had the CD. I now have the vinyl. I'm a vinyl collector. And I kind of wanted to know kind of like two things about you mentioned Yngwie. Was he open? Like when a song like Heaven Tonight or Crystal Ball or Dreaming, like those are songs that really he never really did before. Was he like, oh, wow, this is great, Joe. These sound fantastic. These are melodic. Or was he like, these are great, but this is not what I do. Like, was he on board with that melody and that accessibility that you brought?
Well, not entirely. He was on board with the record company's excitement with what was happening with me and the band. When they would hear these, even the roughs of these songs, they would be going, oh, this is what we wanted. Jim Lewis, for example, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Heaven Tonight, my God, this is huge, you know, yeah. So on and so forth. It's radio, bam, you know. So he kind of diminished his hatred, I guess. Yeah. For example, the song Dreaming, which I think is one of the most beautiful ballads. And I think he plays so perfectly. I yes. really do.
Yes.
Very emotional. He doesn't overplay. On most of the album, I think he's right in his lane.
Yep.
His working title of that track was called Tell Me. And, you know, you always have a working title, but there's no lyric to it. There's no melody to it.
Yeah.
When I turned it into Dreaming, to this day, he still has in parentheses.
Tell me.
Yeah, I know. I'm looking at it right now.
Now that is such a great tidbit because I always wondered. I don't think Tell Me. Why is that in there?
Yeah.
So he couldn't let go of the working title.
Couldn't release it, you know. But I mean, you know, he'd have a cool title like Ride in the Dungeons was his title. Yeah. So I said I'll write it, but I wrote it not only about like a physical thing. But a spiritual thing where we are like imprisoned by governments and schools and institutions that we are enslaved as a people, as humanity.
Yep.
You know, so I was always trying to throw that edge because I'm a very occultish kind of guy and all this stuff, as witnessed by Belly of the Beast, my last album.
Yes. But
yep. Oh, yeah.
We'll get into that. But anyway, so he was like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. But just holding on to that Tell Me. You know, but then the love songs, for example, I mean, Heaven Tonight is a love song, but it's tough. It's brilliant. It's great. You know,
beautiful. I love it.
And I mean, take Rising. I said, you need a name. You need a Rising Force. That's the name of your band. You need a signature killer. Rising Forces, again, our energy is rising up and being powerful and making the chance. I mean, you know, how could you fight that? Hold on, one of people's favorites, you know, Crystal Ball.
That's my favorite on the. I think that is spectacular.
Yeah, Tom is wrong. The best song of the album is actually Rising Force.
There are no bad songs on the album.
I'm just giving him a hard time.
I know
that song to me when we got back into it because I had bought this album as soon as I saw that Yngwie hired you, and you see the videos and stuff, and you jump out and buy like, oh, great. Now he's going to be playing a little bit closer because I had Trilogy before that and it was okay. I didn't like the first couple albums, but this one was, you know, Jolin Turner's now on it. Just the phrasing, and I don't know how I can explain it because I'm not a musician, I'm not a singer. Just like in I Said I Surrender, the same thing here on Rising Force. The lyric, I believe, is when you get into the pre-chorus, when you start singing The Lightning Strikes, just the way your voice goes up and just floats with it. It's that melodic delivery, which you can't describe, and you can switch people out left and right. Ain't people doing it like you do it. So I got to give you credit. And that's why, to me, that's the touch that you provide when you start coming into these bands. And it's, you know, I got a couple live albums here from you. I just picked this one up. Tafts. It's like Tafts and Toffs, right? That's a radio show you guys have done.
Okay.
I can hear you play, and which is amazing on this, because you guys do like Smoke on the Water. You do Spooky Old Rainbow. You do some Graham Rainbow. Everybody, you can hit all of them. It's a little different when you're doing their song, but you still put your touch on it. And your touch is that melodic voice that we all love from the 80s. And it just sticks out completely different. And I wish, absolutely wish, you're so right, that you guys were able to get that last album after Bent Out of Shape. I don't know what happened there, but why didn't that come about?
Money. Real quick, I'll tell you exactly what happened. We were planning on doing another record, and we were coming back from Japan all beat and tired, and we were going to – that was our last bit of the tour. We did Japan, and I mean – we toured Japan,
yeah,
you know, like 3-4 nights at Budokan alone, you know.
Wow, nice.
Opera Sun Palace 2 nights, you know, 20,000 a night. So anyway, what happened was is that the manager came up to me in my seat and said, oh, you know, Richie really wants to put Purple together. And he told Richie, Joe really wants to be a solo artist with Elektra Records and all this stuff. And the next thing, you know, BMG came in with some money or whatever it was. And they went back to the Purple stuff.
Yeah.
So it was like one thing that people don't realize is that bands are not necessarily always best friends.
Oh yeah.
This is a working relationship. Mm-hmm. It's really a professional relationship. If you become, of course we become friendly on the road. We go out, we drink, party, whatever. But it's not like right now. You don't talk to people. You don't pick up the phone and call them. Very rarely. You know, in fact, I have friends from other bands that I talk to, but not the band I was in. So there wasn't a lot of chatter between us and communication saying, hey, what do you really want to do? Is this really true? Is this not true? What, you want to be a solo artist? You don't want to be in Rainbow anymore? Like the manager said, I said, we only found out a couple of years after it all crashed and burned that we were played. That had we known, probably it would have been a different decision. I really believe that because we had no problems between us, Richie and I, for example.
You know,
absolutely not. There was no arguments between us. We wrote really great stuff together.
Yeah, you did.
Absolutely,
you did.
Absolutely, but you still worked together afterwards because you wasn't he there when you were there with Deep Purple? You still worked with them.
He's the one that got me into Purple, in my opinion.
Right.
I think he just said, you know, it's Joe the Highway. You know, I'll leave, you know, whatever. That's what I think. I mean, I went up and auditioned, you know, and I earned my keep again. For example, Cut Runs Deep. That was the exact chorus I sang the first time. I still have a briefcase with all lyrics and things. And I just would, Richie would call it my magic bag. And I'd pull it out and I'd say, this one seems to fit. And I'd sing it. And they were shaking their heads. Yeah, this will work because they needed somebody to also write. Having written with Roger and Richie before, there was no problem.
Yeah.
You know, we knew we would make a good, the songs on Slaves and Masters.
Yeah.
That's a great record. I don't care.
I agree with you.
You know, it's a great record. Deep Rainbow. Call it what you, well, there's three guys from Rainbow, four guys from Rainbow. What do you expect?
Don, you and Richie.
What do you expect it to be? You know, you got Jimmy. I mean,
Roger.
Geez, you
know. Yeah.
But at the same time, just listen to the music. The playing on it's great. The arrangements, the composition, you know. So I digress. So what I'm trying to say is that I really believe he just said we should have Joe come up because they had a singer. And they said Joe should come up here and at least give it the last try. And I went up to Vermont in this old ski lodge, abandoned ski lodge, where they were rehearsing and just nailed it, and that was it. I never went back home. I stayed up there, and we started. I was in the band.
That's amazing.
Kind of leads me to kind of my next question, and again, I kind of want to go back to the Odyssey for a minute. The success of that album, the popularity of that album, the commercialism of that album, and one of my biggest things that I wish is that we got more Joe Lynn Turner with Yngwie, and we didn't. Can you share with us, if possible, what led to I'm assuming it was Yngwie, but I don't know. Let's hear it from you. Why there was more Joe Lynn Turner.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, we were kind of all of us. I mean, when I say all of us, I mean, even the Johansson brothers, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, and they were with him forever.
Yep.
Yes. You know, and even they were, you know, very discouraged about things because he started to turn into the dictator, the large personality again.
Yeah.
And Barry Dunaway, bass player, who was perfect, who could play exactly his riffs on the bass. No problem. you know, and we looked good and we sounded good and all this stuff. And he started to become overbearing again. That's just the simple truth of it.
Yep.
And to the point where I just couldn't take it anymore. And in fact, we were out of the band and we got a call to do the Russian thing, Live in Leningrad, which later became. And we had to make a decision whether we were going to put up with the bullshit in order to do this. You know, and we all figured, well, all right, look, let's throw our hat in the ring and let's do this. It's a great experience. You know, it was the second Glasnost in Russia. And we were there before the peace concert, gentlemen. We were there before the we were there before Bon Jovi and Motley Crue and all that. Yep. In fact, we signed the top of the wall as high as we could to the ceiling to make sure they had a sign underneath us.
Yeah. So, awesome.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
We knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so we opted to do it. And I mean, it came out brilliant. That's a great live record. And you could see we played to 22,000 people, 11 nights in Moscow and 11 nights in Leningrad.
Wow. How awesome is that?
22,000 a night.
That's incredible.
Okay. You do the math.
Right, yeah. Right.
That's why I still have a huge fan base there. Huge fan base. And, you know, I go and play for people. I don't play for politics. I play for people.
Yeah.
Fuck you and your fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
I'm not listening to some fucking old asshole who starts these fucking wars and shit because people want to rock. People love the music. That's what it's for. That's the great unifier. That's the great, how should we say, decider of humanity. When you put music in front of them, we're all the same. Perfect. So anyway, I digress a little bit.
But that's okay.
We did go on tour with him and we did that and that was the end of it. And he was always complaining, disgruntled, and putting down the record and saying it was love songs. And I don't understand it only because it was his best record.
Exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly. But in his mind, he probably doesn't want to acknowledge it's his best record because it's his best record because of you.
What did we call that?
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's like... the green monster coming in,
right?
You know, a jealous husband or boyfriend, you know, it's like, you're the best girl I ever had, but you're so fucking hot that I got to, you're a piece of shit. What are you kidding? What are you, crazy?
That's now, right.
You know, what's funny is that this is all before he put everybody on the left of the stage and put himself in the middle. I stopped following him, but somebody had told me he does. I'm like, that's not true. There's no way.
One of the funniest pictures in the world.
It's the funniest shit. Everybody's on the left or something or the right, and he's in the middle with this Marshall stack. I don't know what
it's the funniest thing. It almost looks like something on a Spinal Tap.
Yeah, like, what an ego.
Spinal Tap was gentle compared to that.
Right.
I mean, when I first saw that, I had to look three times to go, wait a minute, he's got 90 Marshalls, which is probably not all plugged in, but where's the band? And then the camera slowly...
And they're all shoved over here.
They're all like cinder blocks singing and playing like in the corner.
They're all squashed into this corner, you know. And I'm going... And then I knew, oh, man, he exploded. He totally exploded.
And he wants to sing on his albums now. It's like, buddy, listen.
Nobody wants to hear you sing.
Nobody wants. Well, but nobody has my vision. I've seen some comments from him. It's just out of control because he can get away with it. He has nobody there to tell him, what the fuck are you saying, dude? This sounds stupid. So, unfortunately, that's the way he is. But then again, you know, whatever. I want to jump back to one other previous album. And that is Rainbow's Bent Out of Shape. I remember, Tom, we were at some event. We were either on the Kiss Cruise or something. Yes, okay. We went on the Kiss Cruise.
Twice.
And I think I had my box and I played, hey, check out this song because I know he loves your voice.
Yeah.
And he didn't have Bent Out of Shape. So I played him Fool for the Night. I absolutely love that song. That's another one of those that I say like JLT type vocals. That only he can do it and make it so melodic. And I played that for him. He's like, who the fuck is that? I'm like, that's Rainbow. That's Bent Out of Shape. That's Fool for the Night. Oh, my God.
Right,
yeah. I absolutely love that song. Any tidbits you can tell us about
great
that?
Great song. Thank you. It's a great song. We you know, we wrote really well. We really, and you want to talk about not commercial, listen to Eyes of Fire.
Oh, yes.
Listen to Fire Dance. Listen to some of the heavier stuff that we did just to prove that we could still do it. And we did it live.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like I was saying, I have that live album I just picked up. And you guys are killing it. And the fact that it has Fool for the Night on it, I was like, yes, I got it. And I have a live version of it. And I absolutely adore it.
I'll tell you, I think Richie played his best in that incarnation. He really? Was on fire.
Yeah.
Every night he was on fire. He really played his heart out, man.
Oh, Death Alley Driver, the guitar.
Oh, my God.
That,
that song, it's incredible. Oh,
right. I mean, he didn't lose his rock sense. He still had it. He just played it for the song, which is something Yngwie will never understand. But he made good songs. I don't need a killer guitar. I need good songs with great guitar.
There you go. You know, you just hit upon it. The big difference is he plays for the song. He writes, you know, he makes sure the song is there compositionally. You know, as Yngwie makes sure that there's something there so he could play on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over, more or less. That's where I came. For example, in Dreamin', I'll tell you a short story, a real quick one, too.
Yeah.
You know, if you know the song well enough, you'll know the bridge. The bridge of the song says, "And then I find out where I find you." You know, that was all guitar solo. And I said to Jim Lewis, I said, Jim, because Jim came to the studio and I said, Jim, this is a bridge. This is a vocal bridge which separates the verses and the chorus from the next instrumental part, change key for the guitar solo, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
He said, pushed back the mic. He said, sing it. I had the words ready, everything. I sang it. He pushed the button. The guitar came back in perfectly. And that was the guitar solo after that.
Wow.
Yngwie had no choice of that. Jim Lewis was executive producer. So he just said, that's the way it's going to stay because that's the composition of the song. That for the song.
It's incredible. Exactly. Incredible.
Exactly.
Incredible. Joe, before we appreciate all the time you've given us, but we can't let you go without talking about a couple of projects that you've had that we know some of our listeners are big fans of. And I'll be honest, I'm new to kind of it being exposed to them. And those are the projects that you do with Mother's Army and Sunstorm, which are fantastic because, again, Zeus and I, we just want to hear Joe Lynn Turner sing, perform. Tell us a little bit about those projects and how those came to be.
Well, Sunstorm started out as my demos that I had a lot of AOR stuff demos that were never recorded. Mm-hmm. And Serafino over at Frontiers, he heard there was a demo tape rolling around the world for, as a matter of fact, with like about 7 songs on it.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, you get those drunken nights in your room, you know, partying. People lift the cassettes.
You know, right.
That's awesome.
So anyway, it went around and it got duped and everything else. And it was a lot of it. So Serafino had it. And he phoned me up and just said, listen, I'll make a whole series out of this, of your songs and AOR stuff. So that's how it started. It started really organically, and it started with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I really loved the first couple of Sunstorms I did because we stayed true to form.
Yep.
You know, and the production was great with Dennis and everything. So after a while, it started to get stale because he started to use the in-house producer. And I wasn't, let's put it this way. I was very disappointed in his treatment of an artist. I was signed with big bands, big labels. It wasn't about money. Yeah, it was about professional treatment, you know, and I really didn't appreciate his attitude or the attitude that Frontiers was giving out contractually, which my contract was really just on an album for album basis. I would not sign anything lengthy, which I could tell you the trouble that Dino got into. It's crazy stuff. Sure. So anyway, I just said, I'm not doing anymore. I would have to rewrite some of the things that Alessandro was giving me, and God bless him. But it was just becoming like, after The Edge of Tomorrow, it was just like, okay, that's it. I can't deal with this anymore, really, you know. Great series. They tried to pick it back up again, but as you know, it really didn't happen again the way it should have. Yep. You know, that was a project. They should have never continued it. It was not a band. And because the name sold records, they felt they could get the substitute guy and it was going to work. Mm-hmm. But it didn't.
Yep.
I'm sorry to say.
Yep.
That shit doesn't work ever. You mm-hmm. need the real deal.
That's right.
That's right. And that's right. You.
That's you.
And that's you. Now, here's another thing I would love to hear if this ever has a chance of coming back. And that's Over the Rainbow. Any chance of that coming back? I mean, God bless you. You got about a million people you could get together and create that band again, right?
I'll tell you. Let me. Yeah, you know what? Over the Rainbow.
You do it with Graham, too. You guys can go out together and perform a form of that.
You know, we were just talking, Graham and I. I mean, not less than a month ago, he was like, mm-hmm. why don't we go out on tour together?
Oh, you know? Please do it.
So, you got to come this area if that's the case.
Yeah, right.
Well, absolutely. But what I'm saying is, you know, we started to sniff around to see if there was any interest. And apparently, in the state of the business today, gentlemen, there's not a lot of interest where it would be profitable. Look, I'm not 19 years old. I don't need to sit in the back of a van for 10 hours.
I don't blame
you.
So,
Graham said kind of the same thing to us as well. When he can go to Europe and tour and live comfortably and make a shit ton of money, he's out here trying to find some small club guy who's nickel and diming him over stupid shit.
Yeah, you said it. You know why? Because when you got to do a bridge date, like a Tuesday night, you're in some shithole in bumfuck Iowa, you know, and all they can pay is $1,000 and you get the farmer's daughter to come out to see it. And I'm not trying to disparage anybody, but that's not how you make a living.
No,
right, you know,
correct.
Anymore. Not well. Let's put it this way: when I was 19, I did all of that.
Yeah,
I did all of that.
You were beginning. You're getting
that's
started
right.
in your career. It's worth it. You got to put the effort in. I get it. But what about like a one-off or some? Even a live show you do in Europe, release it as an album, release it as a video. You guys come up, get some other old Rainbow members up there.
We want it. We want it. You got to give us what we want, Joe.
You know something? I want the same type of thing, but what we have to do is find the money behind it.
Yeah.
In other words, some promoter, some organization, whatever. Say even if it was one of the festivals that said, look, we want to put this package together on such and such a date in the summer. Great. We could arrange that. We could do that. But then we know exactly what the terms are and what's going on. Otherwise, you're just fish, you know, you're shooting in the dark.
Yeah.
You don't know how it's. You can't just go, hey, let's start a band to go on tour. You know,
right?
I mean, thankfully, I'm not in that position anymore. But at the same time, would I love to do it? And I loved Over the Rainbow. But I'll tell you real quickly, that the cancer and ego started to seep into even that project, you know, and that's a shame because we were like a dark horse. I remember, I think it was Sweden Rock or something. We were on like the B stage or whatever it was. And all of a sudden we saw this flood of people coming over because we were hitting it. We had Jürgen on guitar and he was playing the Blackmore shit and we sounded good. We were doing all the Dio stuff, the Graham stuff, the Turner stuff. We did all incarnations of Rainbow and people went crazy and they wanted us back. Before we got back there the next year, we were already, you know, broken up because it started. The cancer started to seep into like, hey, well, maybe we could, you know, maybe we should get rid of Paul, you know, and the guy would go, well, let's get rid of Bobby, you know, and I'm going like, you motherfuckers, what are you getting rid of everybody for? We got something going.
Here. Bobby's fantastic. I fucking love his drumming. I mean, he had a takeover from Cozy Powell and he still did a fucking great job.
Yeah.
Look, these guys are super. All of them. Everybody that played was great. Why? What are you talking about? Just because he got the girl and you didn't? I don't know what's going on.
That's fucking hilarious. Hey, and last thing too for me, I want to bring up to you because, I mean,
Mother's Army. Let's go, Mother's Army.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
We're gonna go to Belly the Beast too. But go tell me.
Okay, tell us. I'm here and I want to talk about this. Sure. Mother's Army.
Yeah, Mother's Army.
Between Jeff Watson, Bob Daisley, Ainsley Dunbar, and Carmine and myself is one of the great disappointments of all our careers because that band was amazing.
Look at the names you just rolled off. That is like an all-star band right there.
We never wanted to be called a super group because that's bullshit. But we made such incredible music, you know, and 90% of that stuff, gentlemen, was live in the studio because we were doing different timings. You know, you had to do it there. You couldn't edit that. You couldn't splice that in. And we were using tape. So, hello. Yeah. And even my vocals, I would be in the booth singing while they were playing. It was amazing the chemistry we had. Now, here's the negatives. Terrible management. The manager was not even a manager. You know, he stole money from the advance from the record company in Japan. So a typical, and you know something, you'd think we would have known, right? You think we would have known by then. And I fault ourselves. We all do. But we were so busy making the music, so into the band that we really weren't paying attention. I guess we call it trust. We weren't paying attention. He was telling the record company that we weren't working, and the record and he was telling us that the record company wasn't giving the money. Meanwhile, they were giving the advances and the money to keep going, but he was playing both sides against the middle and pocketing. Yeah, right.
That's a mess. Sad story of rock and roll. You hear it all the time. Even the biggest, all the way down from Elvis,
right?
The smallest band. They always get there's always crooks and shit. And you always hear about this stuff later. And it's like, you know, you're just so hungry to play the music and stuff. And sometimes you can't keep your eye on both. And this is the shit that happens.
And it's our mistake. But, you know, we really were consumed by the music. Now, we just found about 4 months ago, we found 5 songs from the last Fire on the Moon sessions.
Okay.
And we were red hot with this stuff. And these demos are so cool because they're so raw and they're so real. They're like the demos. They're literally demos. Yeah. But what we did was we sent them to our buddy up in San Francisco, and he remixed it and he put a little foo-foo dust on it, shall we say. And they're good enough to put out in the public. So we went back. Right. So 5 songs. So we went back to Edel. Edel has a 3 box set, you know, a 3 record box, CD box set of all the Mother's Army.
Yep.
But so far, I just talked to him today, and so far they're like, it would cost us too much to make the packaging. It costs us too much to publicize it. It's not exactly, it's yesterday's news. And we don't think so. So now we're trying to figure out what to do with this. So I just told him, I said, Dr. Drew Thompson's running it. So I said, Drew, just give it, we'll just put it out on Spotify for free. We don't want any money.
Yeah.
We don't want any advances. We don't want anything.
Just get out there.
We put in our own money to remix it and master it.
Wow.
Yeah, because you know why? I have them in my computer. I want to hear it.
Right.
You know
what I mean? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I want it on CD, brother.
Right.
I don't want to listen to Spotify. I fucking hate it. You got to get me on a tire. I want the CDs of all your stuff, and so that I can eventually download it to my computer, put it on my phone. Right. I won't pull out a CD, but I want to buy the hard copy. I want the artists to get their money, and to have something I can read the liner notes. I can read the thank yous. I can read the lyrics. All right.
Old school. Like
That's right.
Roll your weed on the album cover.
There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect.
You know, this is what's about. You know who produced it. You know who wrote this. That's the interesting. Do you know these kids today? They like a song on Spotify, which sounds like shit anyway on Spotify. Yes.
Yep.
And they got one song. They don't know who it is, who did what. No, never heard of it. And that's it. I mean, it's like, what?
It's disposable. It becomes disposable to them.
No, yeah. I want to take the Mother's Army box set and then have that EP on there too. And then I can be like, you know what? I just want to hear them. I want to put it on my phone and hit shuffle and hear any song by them pops up. I can't do that now because I got to go from my iPhone on Apple to Spotify. Like,
yeah, that's really hard, Zeus.
It is, because you can't hear it all the same at the same time on one album.
I know.
And it's a pain in the ass. I hope you get some success and are able to find to be put that on some sort of a release, and that'd be great for all of us.
Yeah. Well, you know, we may have no choice just to put it on our own platform.
Yeah,
our
I'll take something over nothing.
Me too. Yeah.
Because we need to get it out to the public, because the people who do know about Mother's Army love it.
Yeah.
And this would just put it right over there. It's the cream on the on the cake.
Right? Let's talk about your last solo album, the latest, Belly the Beast.
Okay. Yeah, which is about that. Original Paintings right behind me, by the way. That's a friend of mine. It's an amazing. Awesome. I knew this was going to be the cover like a year before I finished the record.
Yeah.
I got to give kudos to Peter Takarin, because my co-writer and producer, Peter from Pain, Hypocrisy, 5 years before that, his brother is a big fan of mine, wanted me to play at his party up in the Sweden, above Stockholm. So we went there, and afterwards there was a bunch of guys like from Sabaton and people, and we were all partying. And Peter said to me, "We should make a record." And I said, "Great." I go, "You know, from my genre and your genre, we'll make a marriage and blah blah blah."
Yeah.
Well, he said he gave me a cassette to take home.
Yep.
And I wrote to it, sent it back to him, you know, and he just was like, "This is great." Then he was on tour. I was on tour. Things got kind of low key. Pandemic hit, and we said, let's finally do the album virtually. So we did everything by files and WhatsApp and Viber and computers and you name it. And so I love Peter. He's amazing talent. And he, in my opinion, made my dream of what this record should be. I wanted it to be a lot more messaging. I wanted it to be a lot more artistic. I wanted it to be a lot more mature in a sense. And if you listen to it, you'll find all of those factors in there. And we did accomplish what we set out to do. We got message and we got metal mute. We got it's commercial still. The hooks are there. The voice is there. Great writing on both our parts.
I agree with you.
And for me, it's, you know, I took a lot of flack because there's certain things in there that people politically don't agree with. Well, I'm sorry if I offend you, but I shall be redeemed one day. The truth will come out.
I think it's a great effort. And, you know, for your group and age that we're all part of, to keep playing and keep putting new music, I enjoy it a lot, because you're still creative and you still need to get stuff out. Mm-hmm. You're not you're not being a legacy act out there, and which is what we do for our podcast. You know, the main podcast is a Kiss podcast. God bless them. We love them. But they became a legacy act the last 15 years, just playing the greatest hits and touring and stuff. I'm curious, because we did see your little comment to Steven when we're talking about, like, hey, let's get, you know, have Joe come on. It's like, yeah, but aren't they a Kiss podcast? I thought I got a little hint of like, Kiss isn't your bag.
No, the fact of the matter was, I really didn't know what your podcast was about and who you spoke to a lot. I wasn't aware of you guys. I'm sorry to say.
No, it's okay. But
what I'm trying to say is that if we were going to talk about Kiss, I'm not a very good source.
Yeah. Okay. You
know, I knew those guys in New York.
That's what I'm curious. That's what we want to leave you with. Like, tell us some Kiss story or your thoughts on the band.
Like my co-writer of all my solo albums is named Bobby Held. Mm-hmm. And he went to school with Paul.
Oh,
and,
really?
You know, and all this kind of stuff. So there was a lot of interaction at the clubs and at Bobby's apartment and all that stuff. So it was like very normal to see Paul, and Gene would come strolling in, you know, and what have you.
Yep.
And he was always Gene, you know,
character.
You know,
yep.
Yeah. If you see a skinny girl, you go, "Why don't you eat a sandwich?" You know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, typical Gene.
Were you a fan of their music? I'm just curious.
Well, in the beginning, I mean, Kiss was like, okay, hey, these guys are great. They got a, they've got a shtick. They've got a, they actually sing and play, you know, they were rocking, you know what I mean? I think only later, in my opinion, it became a bit, they took the makeup off and I went, okay, that's a great era to take the makeup off and just still be playing your music, believing in it. That's integrity.
Yeah.
And then of course, I think, you know, when Doc McGee came in, all this stuff, they just kind of went back to like, now it's a circusy thing. It's, you know, I mean, look, I was going to see Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix, you know, you know, I was into a different headspace with that stuff. You know, I could appreciate what they were doing.
Yep.
Look, I love Twisted Sister. I know those guys intimately as well.
Mm-hmm. They grew up,
all of these guys, I also, Lou Gramm, Black Sheep, we play that area with the New York, the tri-state area. Come on, guys. We go up to the Paradise in Boston.
Yep.
The Paradise.
Yep.
We were all in it together, that East Coast thing. You know, it was all the same. So you knew most of these people. Absolutely. Yep. You know, I mean, Bobby still got an original Kiss jacket.
Nice.
You know, I mean, that's gold. That's gold. You know, so.
Thank you. But I mean, sell it to Gene and make a couple bucks.
Wait a minute. There's a story where they asked for it back. So,
but no way.
Oh, come on.
I make the sign of the cross. I swear to God.
God.
Never mind.
Okay. That's okay.
All right. Maybe you can tell us off the air.
Yeah. Hey, Joe, before we let you go, tell our listeners, you know, we always tell our guests to plug away, you know, websites, concerts, merch, products, wherever they can find you. Tell people where they can find you if they want more Joe Lynn Turner.
Let's see. Well, joelynnturner.com, obviously, official. Instagram, Facebook, it's all there. Just, you know, it's so easy to find. I mean, you trip over it, you know.
Yeah.
It's that easy. And personally, then I'm on Spotify. You have to be and so on and so forth. And I do okay on Spotify, but you know, you don't make any money from that. You know that.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
None.
No.
Yep. None. So it's not about money anymore, really. It's really, I mean, if you want to make money, you got to go on tour and sell merch and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I do my tours. I do selective dates. And I'd love to see my people out there because I can now pick and choose where I want to play, how often.
That's
why.
Great.
Yep. You know
that's
what I mean?
Great. That's great.
And for me, that's, I got family and things like that. And that's just family first was always that way with me. Remember, I'm an Italian from New Jersey.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
I love it.
That's
love
right. Well, he is the great Joe Lynn Turner. This has been an honor and a thrill, Joe. Thank you so much for giving some of your time to us. We appreciate it so much, and we know our listeners are going to love it, too. Thank you.
Well, you guys are great. I mean, honestly, and I wish you all the luck in the world because you guys are old school, and what I mean by that is not in a negative way. That is in the real, genuine music lover way.
Much
and
appreciated.
I wish millions of people would listen to you guys and your opinions because you're right on target with that stuff.
That's right.
Joe, thank you so much, buddy. God bless you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Tom, that was JLT. What do you think?
I mean, we say this a lot, but that was truly one of the most enjoyable interviews we've ever done. He was refreshingly honest, hilarious. It was another one of those conversations where it felt like we had known him for years. And it was just a thrill to talk to him, especially about an album that for a lot of people is like a niche album, that Yngwie Odyssey album. I know we're both Rainbow fans. You're a bigger Rainbow fan than me, but what a thrill. Awesome conversation.
Yeah, it's funny because like we're lucky sometimes to get guests that don't have a time schedule. So we're like, oh, we don't want to keep you. He's like, no, I'm good. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he was enjoying himself. We were off the charts enjoying ourselves.
Yep.
But
yep.
The fact is, Tom, as you mentioned, you would go back to the Yngwie stuff and he said some stuff. I'm not sure if he said it publicly before because we asked some specific comments about certain things. Boy, did he get a kick out of talking about Yngwie stage presence now.
Oh, yeah.
With people on the, he was dying laughing.
That was great. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and then me, I love his rainbow stuff. And I can't get enough listening him tell me about it. And it's funny because off the air, as soon as we hung up, I started getting into Can't Happen Here and how much I love that song. And he was going on. Oh, my God. He was so much fun. And we'll definitely have him back. And we hope that you guys enjoyed the talk with JLT. Until next time, peace out, Girl Scout. Did you? I feel like I'm just like, I didn't know if you wanted anything else to say. Are you good that I just
no? Nope. That's kind of how we do it. You bring me in.